Welcome to the Future of Pharma with ISP Boston, where I talk to the thought leaders of the pharmaceutical industry about where our industry is headed and what you can do about it. I'm your host, Samir Gondalia. Thanks for joining us today.
My guest today is Dr. Arindam Bose. Arindam is currently an independent consultant in biologics process development and manufacturing, following a 35-year career in bioprocess development, clinical supply manufacturing, external partnering, and advocacy for science-based regulations for biologics at Pfizer Worldwide Research and Development, from where he retired as a vice president. He served as the technical lead of the team that developed and executed Pfizer's strategy for entry into the field of biosimilar medicines. Dr. Bose is a member of the U.S. National Academy of Engineering. Additionally, he was elected Fellow of American Institute of Chemical Engineers, American Chemical Society, and American Institute for Medical and Biological Engineering. In this chat, Arindam and I talk about the biologics development journey from the 80s till now and what it will look like in the future and what it means for the pharmaceutical industry. I have personally benefited from Arindam's wisdom when we both were working for Pfizer, and he has had a very profound impact on my career as well. Here's Dr. Arindam Bose. Good morning, Dr. Bose. Welcome to the Future of Pharma. Thanks for joining us today. How are you doing today?
Well, I'm doing good. Thank you, Samir.
So let's begin at the beginning. You have been around the pharma industry for decades, about 40 years. Tell us how the biotechnology, biopharma world was in the 80s and how it evolved. Tell us your initial involvement in the biotech foray.
Well, Samir, I come from the fermentation background, and we were using fermentation for a long time, going back to the Second World War period thereafter, for manufacturing antibiotics. And some of the learnings from that was what was leveraged to get into protein biopharmaceuticals. Before the 80s, essentially, you had things like insulin and human growth hormone. Those were protein products on the market, but those were extracted from human tissues or cadavers or whatever that might be. And initially, the biotechnology was seen as an alternate to that. Essentially, instead of extraction, you could bring robustness to the supply chain by using a biotech method of production. So that was the initial driver, and that's why the very first product of biotechnology to reach the market was insulin, followed by human growth hormone and others. But what really led to the blossoming of the biotechnology industry, starting in the late 80s, early 90s, was the advent of monoclonal antibodies and the technology to come up with recombinant methods of producing full-length antibodies.
Which we are still using today, the monoclonal antibodies and the technologies.
Very much so.
How would you describe the promises of the biotechnology in the 80s versus what has been delivered? I know it was very exciting time. If you talk to people from 80s, if you read literature from 80s, you know, books and articles, there was so much excitement. How would you describe promises versus delivery of the biotech revolution?
I think the promises that were articulated in the late 80s has finally been realized, but what was anticipated then, that the promise would be realized in 5 years or less, that didn't pan right out. It has taken 30 years. And you can see the same thing with gene therapy or cell therapy. There was a lot of activity in cell and gene therapy in the early 90s. And then there was essentially a moratorium on gene therapy that prevailed for years till essentially gene therapy has come into vogue now. And I think a lot of times, what took the most time was translating the lab techniques to industrial scale and industrialization. it takes a lot of time to adapt what was practiced in the lab to use the same kind of scaled up versions of those for large volume production or even patient specific therapies.
So the scale up was the challenge. I think something, just because you can produce something at the lab scale doesn't mean you can produce in 6,000 liter bioreactor. But we have made some strides, and you are right. It has taken decades instead of few years that we were hoping. Do you consider anything lost opportunity, something that showed lot of promise in 80s in early biotech development, but for one reason or another that was not pursued?
No, I wouldn't say that is the case, because what happened is a lot of products were proposed in the late 80s and 90s, and because of the lack of the commercialization technology, they were put on the back burner for a period. But then once the recombinant monoclonal antibody production technology became available, those products were revived. So they did come along, but perhaps they came along 10 to 15 years later than otherwise would have been the case. One thing I wanted to point out is the contribution of the purification scientists. Unlike in the upstream end, where the technologies that were used for antibiotic or specialty chemicals production previously could be leveraged for biopharmaceuticals, that wasn't the case on the purification side. And the reason for that being is that the biotech products are heat labile and also not that stable in a harsh chemical environment. So a lot of the unit operations that were used in the fermentation industry for purification, like solvent extraction and distillation and things, could not be used for biopharmaceuticals. And so where most of the time was spent was perfecting chromatography, which was in the 70s and early 80s, and analytical tools to kind of transition them from being analytical tools to process technology.
In 80s, while we were learning about biologics, the science and promises, FDA was also learning with us about the biologics. How has the FDA's handling of biologics evolved over time?
I think the way it has evolved is when biologics were a new technology, as you recall, FDA has two centers. There's a center for drug research and evaluation and research, and center for biologics evaluation and research. In the early years, most of the biotech product, like monoclonal antibodies and therapeutic proteins, belonged to the biologic side of the FDA. And what prevailed down there was a very collaborative environment. But as biotech products have matured, the so-called well-characterized biotech products, their oversight has been moved to the drug side. So now the paradigm that is followed for regulation of well-characterized biotech products, the framework is closer to what is pursued for the small molecule drugs. Obviously, there are differences that the FDA take into account. But I think in the 80s and 90s, there was great collaboration between the regulated industry and the FDA to clear the path for biotech product approval.
Now, the same thing I think was happening with our industry, right? Our industry used to be small molecules and biologics. There was clear segregation. But now it's become just pharma. And I think FDA has also merged their knowledge centers. I just want to check one thing. You said something very interesting at the beginning of our interview about gene therapy and how gene therapy was around in early 90s. If you didn't know that, you'd think that all these new modalities, gene therapy, cell therapy, CRISPR, and RNA and all these modalities, they just came of age in last 5 years. Let's talk about how gene therapy was in 90s and what happened then.
Okay, I think the basically the issue with gene therapy of the 90s was that some of the immunogenicity issues were not well understood. And there was a patient named Jesse Gelsinger. I believe he was about 18 or 19 year old at the University of Pennsylvania. And he passed away due to immune reaction to a gene therapy treatment. And that is what led to a near moratorium. It wasn't a formal moratorium, but it led to a long review process for gene therapy till people got more comfortable with it and less immunogenic vectors were developed. And so it has taken almost more than a decade to for science to catch up.
Now in 2019, where we stand with these new modalities, what are your bold predictions for the future, for next 10, 20 years in terms of how these therapies will develop and the benefits to the patients, society, and how it will affect our industry?
I think, as you know, for the biopharmaceuticals, the incubation period is very long. So for something to be right. commercially meaningful as well as basically available broadly to patients, essentially, it has to be, for it to have impact 10 years from now, it has to be in the mid-stage development by now. So for the next 10 to 20 years, I think the new modality that's going to get the attention is going to be gene therapy and perhaps even cell therapy. But I think most of the excitement is around gene therapy in terms of correcting monogenic diseases, where essentially one or two faulty genes can be corrected. In terms of essentially more wider application of gene therapy to diseases whose genetic basis is not fully understood, I think that is the next frontier, and that's going to take probably more like 10 to 20 years to get a product on the market, let's say for heart disease or something of that nature, where not a single gene is contributing to the disease.
We are actually, for some of the not the advanced gene therapy that you mentioned, but few other things, we have lots of products for rare diseases which are in clinic, and hopefully the society will see it in the market. You mentioned about correcting the gene, and there is lots of talks about cancer vaccine. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think what is cancer vaccines? I think there are two kinds of vaccines. There is prophylactic vaccine, which you take before you get a disease, like you get for polio or other infectious diseases. When you say cancer vaccine, they are not prophylactic. They're therapeutic vaccines. Only you take it once you get the cancer. So there is a difference.
Okay. So not everybody has to get it, for polio or mumps.
No, there are some cancer vaccines, like the HPV vaccine, the human papilloma virus, that's already on the market. That is a true prophylactic cancer vaccine. But most of the excitement that you hear about in the cancer vaccine arena is to prime your immune system to fight the cancer when someone gets cancer. It's not that you prime your immune system before you are diagnosed with cancer. So it's a therapeutic vaccine. It's not a prophylactic vaccine.
That'd be nice too. We can definitely use that. And I think that will be much more a particular patient population centric.
Yeah.
You and I have, Dr. Bose, talked many times, and I know you are very bullish on big data and data analytics and how we are not doing enough with the data already available. Tell us what the promise of big data is for the pharmaceutical industry. What are we doing right now? And what are we not doing, something the industry should do to extract the wisdom out of the data?
I think the biggest problem is the sheer volume of the data. In the pharmaceutical industry, project teams come and go. A project team forms to take a product forward, and it disbands when either the product successfully launches on the market or the product dies in the clinical trials. In either case, a lot of the data goes into the archives, but there has not been a good software to really query the data prospectively in the future to go back to the data. A lot of the knowledge that was garnered as part of the clinical trials essentially stays with the people who conducted the clinical trials. And when those people move on or those people retire, a lot of that knowledge is no longer available in a retrievable format. So I think where the benefit of big data is going to come is basically the software first. I think the architecture in which that data is stored, and then following that, the ability to extract meaningful information and meaningful trends out of that data.
So if there is a company out there or there is an entrepreneur out there who can develop a software, analytical software, which can extract wisdom from this data, that might be a good opportunity. And also, I think the first company or first few companies who will start mining the data, we have started doing it, but we all know that we need to do a lot more. There is a lot more wisdom. We don't do data with as much as, say, Amazon, right? For example, or Walmart, or the retailers, they look at data and they target the population and they use the data in such a way that it helps their business, their customers, their employees, their shareholders. So we don't do that much in the pharma industry. And I think that is a huge opportunity.
Yeah.
Another topic that I wanted to ask you about is the non-pharma or non-biologic factors that will affect pharma industry. For example, a few days back, I read about Google's DeepMind, which is artificial intelligence arm of Alphabet. And it beat the scientist at predicting the shapes of protein, which is, you know, basic building block of disease. I thought it was like when IBM computer Deep Blue beat Garry Kasparov in a chess match in the 90s, where we didn't think that machine can beat the humans. But in this case, machine did beat, Google's DeepMind did beat the scientist. Again, this is just one off instance. It doesn't mean it's, but I think it will have, there is a lot to be gained for the pharma industry. What are your thoughts on non-pharma science that can help our industry?
I think in terms of non-pharma science, what can help the pharma industry a lot is it is in the logistics side. Yeah, you mentioned Amazon just a short while ago, but the infrastructure kind of they have built, especially if you go to patient-centric therapies, logistics is going to become a big issue that we can learn from others. And then the entire clinical trial process, there is a lot of wastage and duplication and unnecessary costs built into that. I'm sure as a management science expert could really take a deep dive into it and try to streamline that. Not to say that that has not been going on in the pharma companies. A lot of it is going on as part of continuous improvement, but it may be a more question of integrating the best practices into a viable offering.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, you can always make something good even better.
Yeah.
Now, let me ask you about all the mergers and acquisitions going on in our industry right now. That's your superpower, right? Dealing with mergers and acquisitions. What are your thoughts on all the mergers and acquisitions, where we will end up? So let's say in 40s and 30s and 40s, there were about 1,000 car companies in Detroit. And by end of 50s, there were three, Ford, GM, and Chrysler up until the Japanese companies came along in 70s. Are we headed for something like that, where we all will be working for three big companies?
For the pharmaceuticals, because of the nature of the industry, I don't think it'll be big three or big four, but it could be, it could pare down to big 10 or something like that. That's the more likely scenario.
And what does that mean for innovation and patients, and what does it mean for the industry and the society at large?
I think when the pharmaceutical industry was completely fragmented, with no one company having more than 6 or 7% market share, the revenue that those companies generated was not sufficient for them to play in every therapeutic area. For example, some of the large therapeutic areas like oncology, immunology, neurology, essentially a company could afford to play in one, maybe two. But because of the mergers and the formation of these companies with mammoth revenues, what that has allowed them to do is to be a player in multiple large therapeutic areas, and in a lot of instances, learnings from one therapeutic area has benefited other, cancer being the case in point. Immuno-oncology has come from, has really developed because of the learnings coming from the immunology side of the business.
Absolutely. Also, if you have multiple players competing, multiple companies competing for the same, in the same area, it also becomes efficient, then it becomes more competitive. So first to the market, and then price competitiveness, it becomes better for the patients, versus if there are one or two companies who are treating patients with cancer, there is a chance of it becoming monopoly.
So I think if we end up in a situation with 10 to 12 large pharmaceutical companies, that in itself is not bad.
Right now, the reputation of the pharmaceutical industry is, let me put it this way, the pharmaceutical industry right now is just as popular as the politicians in America. Yeah. And we are not doing a really good job at advocating for our reputation. We are leaving a lot of goodwill on the table. Tell us what you think about pharma industry's current reputation, and what can we do, as you know, what can the employees and the companies at large can do to improve their reputation in the society?
I think there has been a general demonization of the pharmaceutical industry by politicians and other parties with different interests. I think what we need right. to do is to be able to communicate to the public the value of pharmaceuticals, but also how much it takes and why it takes so large amounts to do R&D or of pharmaceuticals. People focus in on the cost of goods, but the cost of goods has very little to do with the selling price of the product. What you're right. paying for is the money that was spent on the nine or 10 molecules that failed in clinical trials before you got one product on the market. The successful product is going to pay for all your future failures. And that concept somehow has to be communicated. But also what has to be communicated is the value of pharmaceuticals to your well-being. If you didn't have that pharmaceutical, what would the quality of your life be like?
Not just that, actually. I hear frequently, you know, people say that, oh, this treatment costs $100,000 or $200,000, and it only extended this patient with cancer, it only extended his life by 2 years, and you know, is it worth it? And I said, you know, why don't you ask the person, you know, ask the mother who saw her son graduate, whether those 2 years were worth it, or a father who saw his daughter get married during those 2 years. And you know, it's all it's not everything is time and money, sometimes it's the value. And as you mentioned, it's not about cost. It's about the value you provide to the society. But no, I totally agree. I think the pharma industry can do much better at communicating the value they are providing, how much risky the business is. People keep saying they make so much money. And I said, well, do you own any pharma stock? And the person says, no, it's too risky. And I said, well, that's precisely the point. Yeah. Also, the complicated science we do, it's inherently so risky. Like the therapies we talked about, gene therapy, cell therapy, billions of dollars are being invested, which might not come to anything in 5 years. And that's a huge risk, not to mention the things we are doing is so complicated and first time ever in history. What are your most satisfying accomplishments? Something, I mean, you had such a long career and you have touched such big projects which are still thriving and flourishing and serving the society. But what are the accomplishments you are most proud of? You think about them and it makes you smile.
I think what makes me really happy are the next generation of leaders of the pharmaceutical industry that I mentored during my years when I was a senior manager in the industry. Many have gone on to into important career positions in the pharmaceutical and the biopharmaceutical industry. I think I take most of the satisfaction in the fact that we have created a cadre of next generation leaders who will carry forward everything that we set up essentially at the beginnings of the biopharmaceutical biotechnology industry, principally in the 80s and 90s. I think there's a cadre of leaders in place who'll be good stewards of what has been built.
You have been mentoring me, so I have a very high bar to shoot for compared to your other prodigies. But no, that is right. We often say that when we in our industry, we say, we talk in terms of patients, we talk in terms of human values. But you are right, there is nothing more satisfying than seeing a person flourish rather than seeing a big building. What would you advise to young professional in the pharma industry, such as myself, who are looking for a long and fulfilling career in this industry to serve the patients and work on the science that will help the society? If someone like me who is looking for a long and fulfilling career in the pharma industry, what would be your counsel?
Yeah, I think basically you have to be always open to learning new things because the knowledge is moving so fast, even for myself. Essentially, recombinant DNA technology was not there in textbooks or in the curriculum when I went into graduate school. So most of what I have done in the pharmaceutical industry has been self-taught. Essentially, the knowledge has been picked up by attending conferences or being active in professional societies. So you have to be really willing to be in a continuous learning mode throughout your career to be successful, especially on the R&D side of the industry, because things are just moving much faster than it used to be the case 10 years ago or even 20 years ago.
And it also offers you a lot more opportunity for growth too with all these new technologies.
Yeah.
Now, that brings us to today. Tell us what you have been currently working on, your current activities, what keeps you passionate and going on still.
I think after my retirement, what I've tried to do is to find the balance between volunteer activities and scientific technical activities. In the volunteer activities, I'm still continue to be busy with the American Chemical Society. Essentially, I serve on one of their committees and I'm a counselor. Hard to believe I've been a counselor for the American Chemical Society now for 25 years and getting ready to go to their annual meeting next week. But beyond that, I'm very, very professionally active. I'm an independent director of a biotech company, plus plus more recently a company of which I'm in the founding group, essentially had a very successful IPO. And then I'm also involved with some private equity firms, advising them on their investment in biotechnology. So effectively, I think I'm more busy. At times I feel I'm more busy now than when I was working in the industry.
Yes, I can just say that. You seem busier than you were when you were in industry. Dr. Bose, before we say goodbye, do you have any ask or any parting words to our audience?
I think my only parting word would be to keep your mind open and learn new things, and keep an eye out and be flexible. I think essentially when I joined the industry, people looked at joining a pharmaceutical industry as a lifelong career. You basically joined one company and stayed with the company for 30 to 35 years, and you got a pension when you were done, and you lived happily ever after. But that kind of linear career progression is unlikely to happen. And I think for people, especially in the large pharmaceutical companies, there are opportunities in other departments for them. And I think I would strongly encourage them to, as part of their career development, to gain experiences in all sides of the business, not be pigeonholed into just doing one thing for the rest of their career.
Right, that is so true, because the traditional roles such as, you know, manufacturing and technician and tech transfer, and they are disappearing. And the new roles are appearing with a combination of different things. And in some cases, when you work on these new modalities, you need a person with totally new skill set, which might be a combination of multiple things. That is such a good advice. Dr. Bose, thank you so very much for joining us today. And it has been a great pleasure to talk to you.
You're most welcome, Samir. I'm delighted to participate.
Hope you enjoyed today's episode. Be sure to subscribe and let others know. Word of mouth is our oxygen. Visit www.ispeboston.org for the comprehensive show notes from today's episode, and also find out more ways to associate with us. Do let us know your thoughts in the comment section. And if there is someone you'd like to see as a guest on this show, thanks again for joining us today. We'll see you next time.